Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Welcome to ID the Future. I'm your host, Ray Bolin, and today we're talking again to Dr. Howard Glicksman, the physician who wrote the excellent 81-part series for the Discovery Institute's Evolution News blog. The name of the series is The Design Body, and it was posted on the ENV website from February 15 to September 2016. So welcome back, Doc.
Thanks for having me back, Ray. It's great to be here.
Now, in another episode, you explained how the body makes sure it brings in enough oxygen into the blood by very irreducibly complex system. And by irreducibly complex, I mean that without any one part of that system being present or simply working properly, the system fails and ultimately the body dies, sometimes fairly quickly. Now, this system uses oxygen centers located in the main arteries leading to the brain, which inform the respiratory center in the brainstem about how much oxygen is actually in the blood. And then that respiratory center integrates or interprets that information, decides if the oxygen level is enough or it's not, and if it's not, sends out messages through the nerves. These nerve impulses then travel down the spinal cord and into the motor nerves, which release their neurotransmitter and tell the muscles of respiration to contract. And so when this happens, our lungs automatically suck in air and the oxygen in the air, obviously, and the oxygen then makes its way to the blood. The oxygen level comes back up to normal. The respiratory center turns off its messages, and experience tells us that's just for a few seconds, and then you're forced to breathe again.
Yes, Ray. You know, and at the end of that discussion, you know, we concluded that since all of the parts have to be present for the system to work properly, you know, never mind the need for the respiratory center to inherently know how much oxygen the body actually needs to live, we saw that Darwin's idea of gradualism was sort of dead on arrival. But today I'd like to take a critical look at another one of Darwin's claims that life came about not so much from random chance, but mostly from the laws of nature alone without intelligent direction. Of course, by the laws of nature, he first meant natural selection acting on random variation. In other words, you know, the survival of the fittest because the fittest have the right genetic composition to survive. But we know that later on he said, and modern Darwinists claim, that it also means that the laws of physics and chemistry must have somehow allowed random chemicals to come together to form biologically significant molecules, which then organize themselves into cells and then highly complex multicellular organisms like us. But I would submit to you and your audience that life does not exist within a vacuum, nor within the imaginations of evolutionary biologists, but within the laws of nature. I mean, think about it. Every engineer and inventor knows that for a system or machine to function properly, it must meet certain specifications. Specifications that must take into account the laws of nature. If you want to have a car go 60 miles an hour up a hill, then you better be sure it has enough of the right fuel to provide the energy it needs and a large enough engine with enough horsepower to go up against inertia, friction, and gravity. You want to launch a rocket into space? Then you better be sure that when the propellants ignite, they provide enough energy to give it enough acceleration to escape the Earth's atmosphere. Well, the same thing applies to the body. Do you want to have enough energy just to stay alive? Or more importantly, for our earliest ancestors, have enough energy to win the battle for survival? Then you better have enough oxygen going to the cells in the tissues to give them the energy they need to do what they need to do.
Well, now, I remember that in that previous episode, you saying that the laws of nature basically are requiring that for work to be done, energy is needed. And that's why our cells die. And so do we when we don't have enough oxygen. So oxygen's absolutely necessary. But there are now more laws of nature to consider for this process, correct?
Yes, Ray. And what I would like to point out here is that contrary to what Darwinists tell us, all experience shows that the laws of nature cause death, not life. Death is the natural consequence of what happens when the laws of nature are left to their own devices, unless life comes up with a mechanism or innovative system like we've discussed previously in other talks, you know, the calcium pumps in the nerve, gland, and muscle cells, or the sodium-potassium pumps in all of our cells to fight against the laws of nature to stay alive. Now, today, with respect to how enough oxygen gets from the lungs to the cells, I'd like to look at another law of nature, the law of solubility. In other words, how well one chemical dissolves within another. See, the universal solvent for life is water. And everybody knows that chemicals like sugar and salt dissolve well in water, but oil doesn't. But you may be surprised to learn that oxygen doesn't dissolve well in water either. So this made the body face a major dilemma, because although it had the mechanism in place to bring enough oxygen from the air outside into the blood, it also needed a special protein called hemoglobin that's made in the red blood cells to transport enough oxygen to the tissues so they can do what they need to do. What I'm going to do is look at the numbers involved and show you how the body controls its production of hemoglobin so it can provide its trillions of cells with enough oxygen to survive. And what I want you to notice is that just like all the other control systems in the body, there's a sensor, an integrator, and an effector that all have to work together so that the numbers add up right. And it only makes sense that if you're teaching about the origin of life, as Darwin has claimed to do, they should have to explain how this system arose while allowing for survival each step along the way.
Well, you got me a little worried here, Doc. I've got a feeling you're going to start doing some calculations here. And there are some non-science people here listening and get a bit nervous when they encounter things like chemical formulas, equations, and numbers. So what's up?
Yes, I know, Ray. And, you know, they're like most of my patients. But I can reassure them if they can do simple arithmetic, they'll have no problem understanding what I'm about to say. And the reason why this is so important is because when it comes to life and death, real numbers have real consequences. And you won't see that addressed in anything that Darwinists write about. Yeah, we've alluded to this before. We've talked about the body having to have the right amount of calcium and having enough oxygen or else it malfunctions and dies. So to stay alive, our body has to follow the Goldilocks principle, because if the numbers aren't just right, it's game over. After all, this is the basis of medical science. Why else do you think we take vital signs and run lab tests, if not to make sure that the numbers add up right? Because we know that if either the temperature or pulse, respiratory rate or blood pressure are out of whack, or the oxygen or calcium or some other chemical level isn't just right, then the patient may be on a path towards death.
Well, it sounds to me like there's another irreducibly complex system coming our way, and if it doesn't work properly, then there are some dire consequences, so let's start the lesson.
Okay, well, about half of your blood is made up of water, with chemicals like sugar and salt in solution. And the other half consists of blood cells, like, you know, white blood cells to fight infection, platelets to stop bleeding, and of course, as we've already said, red blood cells to carry oxygen. Now, the laws of nature state that only about 3 milliliters of oxygen can dissolve in 1 liter of blood. And scientists know that at complete rest, the body needs 250 milliliters per minute of oxygen to keep its vital organs running properly. And with extreme activity, the type our earliest ancestors would have needed to do to prey upon others and avoid being preyed upon, or as I like to say, eat or be eaten, the body needs 3,500 milliliters per minute of oxygen.
So I guess the real question here would have to be, if dissolving oxygen within the blood was the body's only way to transport oxygen to the tissues, would having only 3 mils of oxygen per liter of blood really be enough?
Yes, right. You know, this is the sort of question that naturally comes about once you realize how life has to work within the laws of nature. Now, to answer it, we need to know how much blood travels throughout the body within a minute. Now, at complete rest, the heart pumps out about 5 liters per minute of blood. Since there's only 3 milliliters of oxygen dissolved in 1 liter of blood, if this were the only way for the body of our earliest ancestors to send oxygen to the tissues, their circulation would only have been able to provide their cells with 15 milliliters per minute of oxygen. Remember, you got 3 milliliters of oxygen in a liter of blood, and there's 5 liters per minute traveling throughout the body. So 5 times 3 is 15. And
okay,
this represents just the 6% of the 250 milliliters per minute of oxygen they would have needed. And of course, with extreme activity, the type needed for our earliest ancestors to survive, the heart pumps out about 25 liters per minute of blood. Once again, since there's only 3 milliliters of oxygen dissolved in 1 liter of blood, this means that their circulation would only been able to provide the cells of their body with 75 milliliters per minute of oxygen, or about just a little over 2% of the 3,500 milliliters a minute they would have needed.
So it sounds like the body's a little on the short side, so I guess this is where hemoglobin comes into the picture. But then the question comes up there, well, where did hemoglobin come from? And also, how much oxygen can hemoglobin actually carry? And how does the body control the production of hemoglobin and to make sure the body has enough for what it needs to do?
Right to the bottom line, eh, Ray? I like that. So these are exactly the types of questions that students using critical thinking would be asking if they knew how life actually works. Now, hemoglobin, as we said, is made in the red blood cells, and it contains iron, which is able to bind to oxygen so it can be transported in the blood to the cells and the tissues. And just like all the other control mechanisms in the body, the one for hemoglobin has three parts, a sensor, an interpreter or an integrator, and an effector. And it's irreducibly complex, meaning that without any one part being present or working properly, the system fails, there's not enough hemoglobin, and the body dies. So first, there are cells in the kidneys that are thought to sense the oxygen content of the blood, which is an indirect measure of the number of red blood cells in the blood. Now, these same cells then integrate this information about oxygen and, in response, send out a certain amount of a hormone called erythropoietin. I know that's a 25-cent word there. But in medicine, we short form it down to EPO, erythropoietin, okay. EPO. Now, this hormone, EPO, travels in the blood, and it attaches to specific EPO receptors on immature stem cells in the bone marrow, and it tells them to develop into red blood cells, which produce hemoglobin.
Now, we know that the bone marrow is where all of the cells for the blood are produced, but I seem to remember that red blood cells in particular only last about 3 to 4 months in the body. So how many red blood cells does the body have to produce, and how does it know how many to produce?
Well, good questions, Ray. Since we just figured out that 3 milliliters of oxygen per liter of blood wouldn't have allowed our earliest ancestor to even exist, never mind try to win the battle for survival, we can now go back and figure out how much oxygen would have had to have been in their blood for them to first live a complete rest and then to win the battle for survival. So if the body needs 250 milliliters per minute of oxygen at complete rest and the heart pumps out 5 liters per minute of blood at this activity level, then the blood would have to hold at least 50 milliliters per liter of oxygen instead of just 3 milliliters per liter. Now, how do we get that? We take 250 milliliters per minute, we divide it by the 5 liters per minute, and we get 50 milliliters per liter.
Okay.
Now, if our earliest ancestors would have needed to use 3,500 milliliters of oxygen per minute to win the battle for survival, and their hearts would have been pumping out 25 liters per minute of blood, then their blood would have had to have had 3,500 divided by 25, 140 milliliters per liter of oxygen instead of just 3 milliliters per liter. Now, when we take into account the fact that the cells in the tissues cannot extract all the oxygen from the blood, otherwise there would be no oxygen in venous blood, and this is just not the case. When we draw blood from the veins, we know there's oxygen in there, all right? So it's estimated that the tissues at the most can take maybe 75, maybe 80% of the oxygen out of the blood when it's needed. And then we also have to factor in how much oxygen 1 gram of hemoglobin can carry, which is what you were asking, Ray. When we take all this together, we find that for the body to survive at complete rest, its blood would have to contain about 40 grams per deciliter of hemoglobin. Now, in America, the units we use is 4 grams per deciliter. In other words, 1/10 of a liter. So instead of 40 grams per liter, it would be 4 grams per deciliter. And for those of you who donate blood or are familiar with this, this would mean a hemoglobin level of 4. Now, This is borne out in clinical practice because it is extremely rare. I can barely remember at all ever seeing a patient alive who had a hemoglobin less than 4. But most importantly, when it comes to our earliest ancestors being able to win the battle for survival, we find that to be able to do what they needed to do, their blood would have had to have contained about 135 to 150 grams per liter, or, as we say in America, per deciliter, 13.5 to 15 grams per deciliter. In other words, a hemoglobin of 13.5 to 15. And what do you know? As luck would have it, the normal range for hemoglobin for a man is 13.5 to 17.5, and for a woman, 12 to 15.5. Now, since, as you said, red cells only live about 3 or 4 months, to keep the hemoglobin level where it needs to be, the bone marrow must produce about 2 million red blood cells per second, which means that in the time that we've been talking, we've each produced about 2 billion red blood cells. But as for where the information came from to make hemoglobin or erythropoietin and the EPO receptors, how the kidney cells know how much EPO to send out, never mind it having to have enough effect in the bone marrow and there being enough immature stem cells to produce enough red cells and hemoglobin, and finally, how all of this just happened to come together while performing a specific function in the intermediate organisms that eventually led up to us, I suggest you ask the Darwinist within our midst, whose answers to these complex questions always boils down to, trust us, it evolved over time.
Yeah, trust us. Well, I guess, Doc, that this type of the stuff that Darwinists should be explaining to their students, not just presenting them with pie-in-the-sky assumptions, as we've all heard in our biology classes, but explanations, obviously, for how each component of each system that we know is absolutely necessary for life could have come about while taking into account the laws of nature. Our bodies, as you said, 2 million red blood cells per second. And I'm so grateful none of us have to think about that. It just happens automatically. And that in itself is just absolutely amazing. So thank you so much, Dr. Glucksmann.
Oh, it's great to be here again. Thanks again, Ray.
Well, this has been Eye to the Future. I'm your host, Ray Bolin, and thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.